Hi, it's Mike with a major announcement. It is not about the gist. It is about something called the gist list. So let me tell you, every day I construct the show by reading and listening and imbibing a tremendous amount of information. A lot of it doesn't make it onto the show, of course. So what do we do with that? What do we do with the effluvia, the jetsam, the sods, but also the odds? Enter the gist list. Every day on Substack, I will be compiling the most interesting, important, maybe unfairly ignored stories that I look at and say, there's something there. You know, we must nurture that which is interesting in this world. Some of these stories do end up as segments. They all start off as ideas. We need ideas. The gist list is designed to interest you, definitely not to waste your time, to make you smarter, to see where I'm heading every day on the gist. So head over to mikepesca.substack.com today and every day to sign up for the gist list. It's Thursday, May 1st, 2025. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Waltz Falls, Wong gone. Mike Waltz, National Security Advisor, and his deputy, Alex Wong, are both out, according to press reports. Maybe official by the time you hear this. Did Waltz serve as a human shield for Pete Hegseth? Both were on the same Signal group chat that disclosed war plans. Sorry, not war plans. Military attack plans. Hegseth has two bronze stars. Waltz has four, including two for Valor. Now, I'm impressed with any amount of bronze stars, but the experts tell me that the regular ones, when they're not for Valor, you kind of get it for serving, not for serving particularly well, other than more decorations than Hegseth. Waltz also has more of a base of support in non-MAGA Republican world, which actually might be a detriment in terms of job security in this administration. Hegseth is kind of Trump's guy, Trump's protege, maybe Trump's project. Listen to how Trump talked about Hegseth in an interview with The Atlantic on April 24th. Here, this is his comments as read by The Atlantic Voice, which sort of elevates everyone's syntax to an unfair degree.
Pete's gone through a hard time. I think he's going to get it together.
Like a young pitcher just called up from the minors, making his debut, having some control issues. Trump was then asked by The Atlantic's Ashley Parker about the job security of each man.
Parker, but for now, you think Hegseth stays? Trump, yeah, he's safe. Parker, does he stay longer than Mike Waltz? Trump, Waltz is fine. I mean, he's here. He just left this office. He's fine.
Safe, better than fine. Okay, I get it now. Hegseth had to face the predictions that he would be fired, and Trump is invested in not having those media predictions come true. Trump also has more of a stake in Hegseth's appointment than in Waltz's. He had to fight for Hegseth. Waltz had widespread appeal among his former congressional colleagues, including among Democrats. That also might not have been great for him if he wanted to keep his job. So let's go on to lessons learned. An after-action report, a debriefing, as they say in the military. Trump came away with some lessons learned, and this one comes courtesy, again, of that Atlantic automated voice reader, which renders the gruff gallant and makes the sleazy sound sublime.
Goldberg, but is there any policy lesson from that, that you've derived and have talked to Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth about, and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz? Trump, I think we learned, maybe don't use Signal, okay?
Okay. Indeed, okay. I won't. On the show today, Joel Souza is the director of the new film Rust. You have heard of Rust, even if you don't realize it. That is the film on which Alec Baldwin was handed a loaded gun and fired it, killing cinematographer Helena Hutchins and badly wounding Souza. That bullet came within inches of both his lung and his spine. Souza later told Vanity Fair, quote, I remember specifically going to sleep that night and hoping I didn't wake up in the next morning. I remember just thinking maybe I'll sort of bleed to death. That would suit me just fine. Souza's wounds included the physical, but also the guilt, the resentment of Baldwin, who had shot him and killed his friend, the burden of an uncompleted film that did represent the showcasing of Hutchins' tremendous skill. And the possibility, the sad possibility to Souza and many who worked on the film, and many in Hutchins' family, that this film would never be shown, that her legacy would be incomplete. But then you also have the pitfalls of bringing it to cinemas. But it was decided, mostly by Hutchins' widower, that the film should be completed. So the cast reconvened, a new cinematographer was brought on, and the film is out tomorrow. Already, some members of the public are appalled about this, but Sousa makes the point that the people closest to Helena Hutchins wanted this to be seen. And so, I did see it, and I talked to Joel Sousa, and that conversation is up next. Rust is a new movie out starring Alec Baldwin. And if the name sounds familiar, you know of the backstory. Alec Baldwin aimed a gun that he thought was not loaded, and it wound up killing the cinematographer, Helena Hutchins. The director of Rust, Joel Sousa, was on set, caught a bullet in his shoulder. They went back. They finished the movie. Proceeds are going to help Helena Hutchins' family. And I have to say, I watched the movie and it's excellent. It's exactly my type of film. It's exactly in my wheelhouse. And Joel Sousa joins me now. Joel, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks very much, Mike. I'm very happy to be here.
So I just want to tell you how I hope this interview will go. I'd like to talk about the movie as a movie, and then I'd like to talk about the making of the movie and how the movie affected your life and the considerations. And you can't not. And I also want to say that I think that I'm sure that you're going to say, because I've read interviews with you and I've read interviews about you, you always talk about Helena and you brought her into this movie and what she meant to you. And at no point do I want to give my audience or anyone else the feeling that that's not the overriding consideration. Yet at the same time, this was a labor of love. This honors Helena's memory. And I think it does deserve to be considered as the art that it is, for at least a portion of this interview, if that's okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So were your inspirations? I saw a lot of John Ford, my favorite director, in here. I saw early on a shot from inside the cabin to the outdoors with someone standing in the doorway, like classic Ford, classic The Searchers. At this point in our cinematic lives and your cinematic life, are you consciously evoking Ford, or is Ford so interwoven into the DNA of Westerns and filmmaking that you can't help but raise John Ford?
I think both. You know, it's an interesting day on set when you're going to do those kind of shots. And we do a few through the doorway because the crew is sort of champing at the bit. Like, are we doing the John Ford shot? Are we doing the John Ford shot? Is this one up today? So it's on everybody's mind. And it is, you know, a form of tribute. But I mean, yeah, I think it's so inexorably tied into the DNA of Westerns in this country. I mean, I came to Westerns through my grandfather and my uncles. You know, they were always, my grandpa, my Uncle Jack, they were always reading every Louis L'Amour book and trading them back and forth, these Jake Logan books they loved. And then they would, you know, I'd go over and my grandpa would be watching McClintock or The Sons of Katie Elder or this and that, you know. And so, you know, that's how I got introduced to movies like Shane and The Searchers and all these obvious classics. I mean, Shane is a really, really big one for me. And you know, so there is this sort of this language of this visual language of the classic American Western. And it's almost like, you know, there's a shot where there's a character silhouetted that comes through the doorway. It's the Alec Baldwin character. And it's, I don't even recall like even thinking about, well, like, how am I going to do this? It was just like, well, this is how you do this shot.
Right, right. Yeah. It's like the Spielberg Dolly close up in Jaws that now everyone knows how to do and you have to do. Yeah, it's like that. It's iconic. Two other John Wayne movies that it reminded me of. Well, you mentioned The Searchers, and so Alec Baldwin's character Rust is a lot like Ethan in that he comes back to rescue a young kid, and also Big Jake, which is I think a grandfather trying to rescue. A grandson yes, grandson. Were those in your mind when you were writing this and making this?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, you know, originally it was going to be, I had conceived it sort of more as a father-son movie, like an estranged father-son movie. And things about it started to feel very shoehorned. Like when you're writing, if you ever feel like you're kind of shoehorning something in that doesn't work, you got to stop and abandon ship and eject everything out of the airlock and just walk away. And so I did that with that. And then I sort of thought, well, maybe if it's a grandfather, it's much more interesting. And my grandfather is easily one of the most important relationships I've ever had with anybody in my life. Anything I know aside from my mom, but what I know about how to treat people and And there are times when I feel like anything I know that's worth knowing, I learned from Joe Souza. And he was, you know, so I wanted to do something that explored a grandfather-grandson relationship. And this obviously isn't that kind of relationship in the movie. It's like Rust is very sort of callous toward him and very doesn't really know what to do with him and doesn't have like an emotional connection at the beginning with his grandson. But I think I probably came to it a little more through that, like my own experiences with my grandfather and wanting to tell a story sort of through the eyes of a grandson.
It's also ambitious in that there are three storylines and we're kind of invested, I don't know if you want to say rooting for, in all of the characters, the bounty hunter, the sheriff, Rust, that's Alec Baldwin's character. He is saving his grandson, who we feel sorry for because he's falsely accused of a murder, but in order to save him, he commits murder.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing, you know, when I originally sort of conceived of it, and I like to generally write a lot of characters in a movie, and with this one, I wanted to sort of come up with the idea of there's this young boy who's kind of just unattached to anything living out in the prairie on his own with his little brother, and just they're struggling to survive, but he doesn't have these adult influences in his life. And so in a way I said, well, I'm going to sort of create these three characters that kind of hover around him for the whole movie. There's the marshal, there's his grandfather, Harlan Rust, and then there's this even worse villain, this Fenton preacher Lang, played by Travis Fimmel, wonderfully by Travis Fimmel. And I thought, well, it's really interesting to think that Lucas could theoretically, there are paths he could take in life where he becomes any one of those men, right? He could become like his grandfather, this sort of person who's embittered by the things that happened to him in life and he turned to crime. He could go to be someone who just is sort of sociopathic and lacks the ability to empathize with anybody the way Preacher is, or he could sort of become like this marshal who on the surface feels like he should be a hero. He's the sort of upstanding lawman, but in his personal life, he's rather cowardly, to be honest, and he sort of fails people. And I like the idea that he could become any one of them. And in reality, he's sort of a more whole human being than any of them already at 13, you know?
Is it hard? I've read some about the financing of the movie. I know that Alec Baldwin's involvement was not just essential. Without him, it doesn't get made. But is it hard to make a Western? It's hard to make any independent film that's had a $3.5 million budget. Does making it a Western, a big sprawling Western, negatively affect the possibility of a movie like this to get made?
Yeah, I think, you know, people always sort of say, there's always a moment where I always go, oh, Westerns are in a big renaissance. And it's like, are they? I don't, you know, because there'll be some Taylor Sheridan shows, but he's almost like his own brand, right? He's his own genre, and they're these fantastic shows. But Westerns are always a tricky thing because some salespeople will tell you they don't travel worldwide. And I think that's nonsense because they do. You know, people are interested in what are...
Well, look, at $3.5 million, if they just travel to like Montana and Wyoming, you'd be okay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, they believe that these truly sort of American stories maybe don't translate to worldwide audiences as much. And I disagree with that. So I think, you know, you're doing a period piece, which is expensive. You're doing things that salespeople sort of maybe don't believe in quite as much. So it is tough, no matter how popular Westerns might be at any given moment, to put the money together and to get all those sales together and all the elements together, the equity, the debt, all of it, just that has to pile together to get this thing off the ground. I mean, we had a decent budget for an indie. You know, I think our budget was $7.5 million to make this movie. And while, yeah, I mean, you know, Avengers 25 will cost $500 million or whatever, that's, you know, a different level of money. But $7.5 million, anyone who knows anything about this business will tell you that's not small for an indie. That's, in fact, probably on the higher side of what people get.
And so now are the proceeds, if there are proceeds, and I could ask you about the distribution, are they going to Helena's family?
Yeah, and that's been the case. That's been in the works for a long time. I think since the movie was even discussed about being completed I know there was a whole like settlement, and I'm not privy or party to any of those, to the terms of that, I think. But what I do know is that, yeah, the money is going to be directed toward Helena's husband and son.
Is this getting distribution?
Yeah. So it's out on the 2nd. It'll be out in select theaters, as they say, which means 150 screens around the country by this company called Falling Forward. And then it's the same day. You can watch it any way you watch movies, on your couch, through Amazon.
Yeah. Right, right. All the ways that just distress directors who work with like setting up a shot,
you
know, and getting the perfect sunset.
You know, yeah. VHS, Betamax were going to be everywhere. But yeah, no, it's you know, I would hope people go see it on a movie screen, but I hope that for every single movie ever made, because, you know, I don't care what, you know, Netflix or whoever says, you know, it's like theatrical thing is important. And we should embrace that that's how movies are meant to be seen. So
there is a hesitancy on behalf of audiences. And I'm just basing this on the fact that it was screened at a Polish film festival, which celebrates cinematography, which Helena was. And there was, I guess, some predictable or unfair blowback, but also reading accounts of this movie, which should have been celebrated for cinematography, there seemed to be a hesitance on the part of the audience to really embrace it. What does it mean if we embrace it? Are we siding with someone who did something wrong? And I can understand a lot of ambivalence around that, not to knowing what to think. And I also can understand it's art, but it's entertainment. And so when you layer on what really happened to this supposed entertainment, it maybe becomes entertaining. But what would you say to address that beyond, look, audiences and the moviegoer is going to interpret it as they do. But if there is some, well, should I really see this movie or like this movie, apart from the fact that Helena's family is getting some proceeds, what would you say?
I mean, I'll take it back to the experience in Poland, because I think it's salient to what I want to talk about is that, you know, I know before there was an announcement, and then like when anything sort of happens with Rust in the media, there'll be some people that sort of take to social media and there's an outcry, and I don't begrudge people that. I mean, I don't, you know, if I was not involved in the situation, I would have specific feelings about it as well. But I think what I came to understand very clearly after I went to Poland is, and I don't want to minimize people's feelings on something, but it's, you know, I don't want to have some giant reaction to 100 people on Instagram. And it's like, I went to the festival really kind of nervous about what to expect. And what I found there was none of that, not an ounce of it, not one cross word about anything. People were very supportive and glad we were showing it, because that festival was incredibly important to Helena. And she wanted this movie to play there, and they thought it was a fitting tribute. And I came to realize that it's as much the current landscape of just how we receive and digest and regurgitate media as anything, that, you know, they'll say Rust is going to come out and the internet is outraged, and they'll quote three tweets from some dude in Ohio and somebody in Lansing, Michigan, and some guy in, you know, so it's like, what? Like, I don't understand. And then that starts to form public opinion, and public opinion starts to sort of cement around that. And I think that's a little unfortunate. That's the kind of thing that happens. But, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like we've made something that honors her work. I mean, Helena is an incredibly talented artist, an incredibly just talented human being. Like, she's just one of those people, man. She's like a touchstone. Everybody, you know, people don't always get along on movie sets. Everybody loved her. Everybody. She treated everybody fairly, kindly with her. She shared her art and her excitement for her art with everybody. And so at the end of the day, just the notion that that might just disappear, her last work would just disappear, that was very difficult for me to accept. I mean, you know, as difficult as it was, the idea of coming back to finish this, and I was very resistant to it. Until it started to become clear to me that, you know, yes, the movie was going to financially benefit the family, and that this is what Matt really wanted. He wanted her art to be shared with people. He wanted her final work.
This is her husband.
Yeah, and her mother wanted her art to be seen and shared with people, and her daughter to be celebrated. And I thought, you know, it sucks that people know who she is because of what happened to her. There was just so much more to her. And you can say that for any victim of something like this. And I think, you know, if people are looking and they're like, oh, while you're looking at this, now you're going to learn something new about her. You're going to at least know this about her. You're going to see how she saw the world. You're going to be exposed to her art. And I think that's valuable. I think that's worthwhile.
maybe someday this movie will be able to be interpreted for what it's intended to be, a piece of art, a statement, entertainment. But now it is all but impossible to layer on, well, some of the good stuff about Helena that you were saying, yeah. some of the, some whatever emotions, come back to the word ambivalent, that we would have. So you can't fight that. But I will just tell you my experience. I thought that was okay because watching it, there are a lot of themes that you don't have to work really hard to see in the story behind Rust and the story that Rust is telling. I mean, there are many guns and there are contemplations of guns and what guns do. And there is someone unfairly accused and in jail for a long time of a shooting. So how do you think about that, knowing that people are going to come with the meta story of the story informing their experience watching Rust?
Yeah, you know, I think it's like you said, I can't really fight against it. So all I can do is sort of fight through it. You know, on one hand, it sounds almost like trite to say, well, I want people to accept this as a movie. And you know, because everything that happened is just so much more important than that. And no movie can ever be worth injuries, much less worse. And, you know, and I think that's all obvious, you know, obviously a given. I think, you know, I hope that people are just sort of willing to give it a chance. And I don't mean, you know, just even if it's something that they saw the story about what happened to Helena and felt touched by it and felt like they wanted to do something, it's like, okay, well, you watch it and this benefits her family. There is something you can do. And so, you know, how it's taken is something, how it exists as a movie in people's mind and just everything else separated from it, just as a film on its own, is something I've really had to kind of let go of, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, Tom Hanks and on the raft in Castaway, when he just knows he's going to die, just sort of lets the oar go and just drifts out to sea. I've had to really let that go. That's a result I can't control for people. And so I hope that if they do choose to see it, they find something valuable in it. They find something touching in the story. I know there are strange parallels that exist about the accidental shooting is sort of the premise of the movie. But there are things for people to take away, I think. Like you're talking about I think it's a very anti-gun movie. In my real life, I'm very uncomfortable with guns. I don't like them. I don't, you know, I wish they were gone. I wish they didn't exist. And I think, you know, this movie, at the center of it, there is this rifle that's been passed down through generations that anybody who ever picked it up, you know, it sort of destroyed their lives. And then those consequences kind of continue to ripple throughout generations. Like the character of Lucas is paying the bill for a meal he didn't eat, you know?
Right. Was that in the original film? If the film had wrapped without the horrific incident that injured you and killed Helena, would that have been as present as it is in the film we now see?
Yeah, it was always there. It was always the main, you know, nothing really. The thing that changed about the movie from the first time we were in New Mexico to where we were finishing it.
And what was the gap in between, by the way?
A year and a half.
Yeah.
And so the thing that most changed about it was obviously we just removed the scene where the incident happened, and then I rewrote some things that led up to that, reconfigured that in its entirety so it bears really no similarity to what would have happened before, and then rewrote a few scenes after. So, but the crux of the movie, the relationship between the grandfather and the grandson, these sort of larger themes about consequences of violent acts and things like that, that was always front and center.
And we'll be back with more of Joel Souza after the break. We'll talk about how the film was completed, and we'll talk about what the reaction has been, what his life has been like. We're back with Joel Souza, director of Rust. And in the wake of the tragedy, there was talk and there was a movement, and some in Hollywood make public declarations, The Rock being prominent among them, saying that his film company was, from this time forward, only ever going to use special effects, not real guns on set. A bunch of cinematographers signed a petition calling for a ban of functional firearms and filmmaking. So I have a two-part question. Do you support that ban? And had you considered any of that before this incident?
It was probably not something that was enormously on my mind before the incident. I mean, you talk about it in a logistical sense when you're planning the movie about, are you using blanks? Or are you going to be using CGI, all that kind of stuff. But it was not something I had spent a great deal of thought on. I mean, after, obviously, I 1,000% support the banning of any functional firearm on any movie set ever again. It should be, you know, they should be holding paperweights at this point and using CGI and all that. But even within that, you still must have trained armorers to ensure that those are in fact what you're using, what you think you're using. I mean, our second go round, we had a great armorer, Andy Wirt, who in some cases, the things we used, everything was profoundly inert. Nothing could fire anything or even was capable of firing anything. There were replica pieces. There were things he just built from scratch, yet treated every single one of them like they had the potential to be a deadly weapon. And that was very important. I think, you know, one of the things in the aftermath of all of this, there has been and there continues to be a lot of discussion around set safety. I think that's fantastic. But I think saying the right thing and doing the right thing ain't the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, like, I remember, so I don't know how long ago this was at this point, a year and a half ago, maybe, I wrote a letter to my union, the DGA, because I know that the safety committees is comprised of committees from each different union, and they all get together to form this safety bulletin. And I've always, you know, in reading the safety bulletin, I found the language can be very ambiguous in it. I think any safety bulletin where two veteran crew members can read it and come away with two different impressions ain't a safety memo. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, and there were some things that I said, look, will you advocate on my behalf that these are things I recommend? And some of the things and some of the wording, they did make a few little minor changes about clarifying some of the wording in some things, but I think there's still ambiguity there. And I think it didn't go nearly far enough.
I mean, maybe they won't talk to you specifically, but why do directors want to be able to continue using functional firearms? Why do they think the potential for danger is worth what you get out of it? What do you get out of it?
I think it's a creative decision as much as anything. And there may be times where they feel like their cast wants the reality of that smoke and recoil and things like that. But I think it comes down to creative choice, I suppose. I know it's something certainly I'll never be around again. I just can't. As skittish as I was about weapons before, you know, it's much more now. But I just feel like, you know, it's strange. The thing that happened on Rust, the odds of it happening are just so microscopically small. The general broader dangers on set are much more prevalent than other things. Like, sets are dangerous places. There's enormous pieces of equipment. There's people moving in 10 different directions all at once. You can trip over things, get whacked in the head by things. There's so many things that are more likely to injure people on a set than what happened there.
Or even the chain of events, as I understand them. First of all, what are the odds that someone has a live round anywhere near the guns? Then what are the odds that this gets into an actor's hand? And then what are the odds that when it's discharged, it's not into the ground or, you know, into some harmless place?
What I hear around is from, like, we were talking to a producer and he says, you know, people are just kind of, they all think it'll never happen to us. That was just somebody else's thing. Never us. Mm-hmm. Which is not a great way to think about it. And yeah, when I was in Poland, Bianca and I were walking through the market there in where the festival is, and there's all these booths that have all the things they're selling. There was a man there who's a retired DP, had a booth, and he and Bianca knew each other a little, and he sort of tells us in confidence, he says, you know, just last week, and this was in November, he tells me, he says, there was a major studio show in LA. They found a live 45 round on set. And he goes, that means it made it from the truck to set, and they only caught it in the final check. A real bullet. I said, well, what is that? He said he wouldn't tell me what the movie or if it was a movie or a TV series.
But a major one, not an indie one.
They were that close. And he says, you know, his takeaway from it was that it's all words. And in reality, not a lot has changed functionally. And I think if that's the case, I think that's very unfortunate. I just, again, people shouldn't conflate doing the right thing with saying the right thing. And I think as admirable as it was for them to update the safety bulletin, it falls so dramatically short of what it should be.
What I was thinking of when you were talking about the directors might want the recoil and the smoke and the authenticity. I mean, I'm sure you can make the case that when Buster Keaton plans it out and stands in the exact place that the house frame is going to fall around him, it was very exciting, and you can't get that same effect from CGI. And yet we know not to do it now, right? And if we had been doing it thousands of times, not every one of us would be as skilled as Buster Keaton, who, by the way, took many licks in his day. So, you know, there's progress.
Yeah.
It's a shame that it comes at the price of tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Have you had... Well, I'll ask it this way. Is Alec Baldwin invited to or going to promote this film at all? Do you think that would help?
No.
Because of that 100 people on the internet effect?
I just, I don't think it would do any good. I think it would be, I'll just say no.
Okay. And have you had conversations with Alec Baldwin where he's expressed, hope, interest, anything to you and the ongoing success or at least existence of the film?
No conversations. We don't talk.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Were you upset with him for shooting you and what happened afterwards?
It's just, we don't talk. There's no, we don't. I'll leave that there.
And what about your, I talked a lot about this on the show and how I personally felt that from what I know, that it was straining what the charge was and what a reasonable DA would have brought with the charge. And I had lawyers writing to me both agreeing and then some people saying that still it was improper way to handle a gun. Put that aside for a second. But what did you come out of your long involvement with the criminal justice system? How do you reflect on that? What did you make of that?
You know, it's... I never really had an experience with that before, talking to prosecutors and being a witness and things like that. I never had sort of seen that process. It was a very, I mean, in one way, you know, I think I expected it to be like A Few Good Men or something.
And like a movie.
You go in there and you kind of walk in and it's a little chaotic and there's a lot of people talking and the way they question is like, and you did this. Okay. And it's very, it wasn't what I expected. And you, what you realize is, you know, the justice system is just, it's very committed people desperately trying to do the right thing under very difficult circumstances. And this one was really as difficult as you can imagine, just given the attention and the craze and the sort of, this is kind of a one of one, like this hadn't happened before. Everyone was really embarking just sort of in really uncharted territory. And so I always try to give everyone a great deal of grace and latitude and just knowing that everyone really was trying to do the right thing. And even for the folks involved, you know, like on the prosecutor side and everything, that really kept, you know, Helena as their North Star. I think, like I said, it was just a really tough situation all around, but I came out of it. There is a sense you're sort of spilled out at the end of it. It's like, whoa, what was that? You know, but I came out of it just sort of, it's not that I was disillusioned or anything. It's just that maybe I was disabused of my Hollywood version of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe not even that. I don't know. I'm guessing, you tell me if this is right. Maybe not even that in Hollywood, everyone's better looking and the sets are cleaner and things seem more orderly, but you're a screenwriter. And for a screenwriter, it's all about structure, 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 yeah. and things happen for a reason. And you seem to be saying real life, though, not a revelation, when you see it really descending upon you, the lack of structure and the lack of three acts and rise and climaxes is just stark.
Yeah, there aren't those sort of, you know, did you order the code red kind of moments, you know, it just doesn't happen. Yeah. So it's very sort of analytical and very detail oriented, super, just so detail oriented in a way that I just hadn't anticipated, really.
So your last movie before this was really critically acclaimed. Thomas Jane starred in Crown Vic. It was an LAPD movie. Do you think that everything you went through will one day show up in your art in some way or another?
Maybe. Maybe, you know, it's interesting because like Crown Vic was an interesting movie because I wrote it. I had spent some time in a hospital and it got really dicey. And then I wrote it like in 10 days afterward. And it was sort of this real examination of fathers and sons to me, even though the characters are not father and son, but I'm sort of, you know, I'm fascinated sort of on the subject of sort of absentee fathers or fathers that didn't live up to what they should have been. And that's very present in Crown Vic. I mean, there's some dialogue in there that just came right out of my mouth in that movie. And so that experience very much colored that movie. And it also, to an extent, colored, you know, my original draft of Rust. That's sort of inescapable in there. But it also, Rust is also filled sort of with my, like, I think the closest character to me in Rust is the Marshal, this Woodhelm. A character who sort of lacks faith.
Who is cowardly.
Yeah, but I mean, he also, like, you know, I've struggled over the years with the question of faith and God and what exists and what doesn't and what we use as excuses and sort of wishing for a truth when you know the awful truth and things like that. So yeah, that's definitely was in there. And I mean, the script I wrote after Rust, there's another, it's sort of, you know, I joked, I'm like, I think I've got all my daddy issues done with the last one because it's prominent. So yeah, they can't help but sort of permeate that.
Joel Souza is the director of Rust. It is in at least 150 screens on May 2nd and soon on a device near you. And this critic's assessment is it is worth a watch. Joel, thank you for everything.
Thanks very much, Mike. I appreciate it. Thanks for the talk.
And that's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara, CBSO of Peachfish Productions, Michelle Pesca. The doyen of the Gist list is Kathleen Sykes. And Leo Baum has been hitting the archives hard and helping us out. So thank you to our intern, Leo Baum. Astrid Green's our social media director. Umpru Jipru Dupru, and thanks for listening.